Laudator Jesus Christus. Praise be Jesus Christ. Welcome, friends, to another episode of Council of Faith. As we look at the post-conciliar documents, the first one we're going to examine today is the Motu Proprio on the Sacred Liturgy. Its Latin title is Sacram Liturgiam. This was issued in January 1964. Recall that the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, Sacrosanctum Concilium, was the first document of Vatican II. This is the first post-conciliar document that we're going to examine today. It's very short, but it has a very essential meaning that we want to look at today. In the first paragraph, we're told that there's abundant evidence of the constant solicitude of our predecessors and ourselves, the bishops of the Church, for the preservation, the improvement, and where needful, the reform of the sacred liturgy. This is a letter written by Pope Paul VI to all the bishops of the world, but also to all the priests and all the faithful. And so he addresses this letter and recalls his predecessors, most notably Pius XII, who was very instrumental in making the preparations for the council and the reform of the sacred liturgy. The preservation, improvement, and where needful, the reform of the sacred liturgy. Yes, there's reform mentioned here, but also the word preservation. We don't hear that mentioned too many times. We hear so many people saying that we have to keep innovating, keep changing, keep adapting. And yes, we see reform mentioned there, but we have the very first word is preservation, improvement. Some things needed to be improved for the better flow of time and the culture. But this idea of preserving the best of the past while incorporating the best of the present and future. In the next paragraph, we're told it is that the faithful, when they thus worship God, the source and model of all holiness, are themselves drawn and, as it were, impelled to holiness, though still earthbound pilgrims, they become, quote, imitators of a heavenly Zion. The faithful, when they worship God, the source and model of all holiness, are themselves drawn, impelled to holiness. This universal call to holiness was one of the hallmarks of Vatican II. That holiness is not just for the priests, it's not just for the nuns in the monastery, the convent. Holiness is for everyone. Because of baptism, we're all made a child of God. We are all called to holiness. And it is through the sacred liturgy, the holy sacrifice of the Mass, and the other six sacraments, that we find God's grace communicated to us in a very special and personal way, so that when you and I go into the world, I as an ordained priest, you as a lay person, single or married, those who are in consecrated religious life, we're all called to holiness, and we will get empowered, strengthened by the sacred liturgy. Pope Paul VI would continue, noting that, again, this is interesting, that this is in 1964. The council is still going on. We draw attention to the fact that apart from innovations which we have introduced in this apostolic letter, and apart from other changes whose implementation we have anticipated, the regulation of the sacred liturgy is vested exclusively in the Church. Let's read that again. We would draw attention to the fact that apart from innovations which we have introduced in this apostolic letter, apart from other changes whose implementation we have anticipated, the regulation of the sacred liturgy is vested exclusively in the Church. That means it is the Pope, or the Pope through the congregation of worship, the cardinal in charge of making sure the Mass and the sacraments are properly celebrated. There is where any changes will occur, and then approval is granted. Now, a request can be made at the local level. The American bishops can ask for special permission to do something, or for a special adaptation, but it must be submitted to the Rome for their approval. Without the approval of Rome, it does not become binding, and many times it doesn't become allowable, or what we would call licit. The Holy Father also goes on, for this reason, nobody else, not even a priest, is entitled to add, subtract, or change anything in the liturgy. Now, what's important to note is this is in 1964. Right after the document, Sacrosanctum Concilium, was enacted, promulgated, what was happening, and I think the Holy Father was made aware of this, while the council was still going on, before any books were rewritten for the Mass or the other sacraments, there were theologians, there were liturgists back home now telling people, now we can do things. And now they were bringing balloons and clowns and butterflies and using all kinds of weird things, pretzels and beer and all kinds of bizarre aberrations. And the people didn't know what was going on. They were being told by these so-called experts, well, Vatican II says we can do this. Well, without having any contrary evidence, people say, I guess so. They know what they're doing. Paul VI wants it very explicit, and we're going to see this again and again, not just from Paul VI, but from Pope John Paul II. We're going to see it in canon law. We're going to see it in the new general instruction that the regulation of the sacred liturgy is the purview of the universal church. There'll be a few instances where particular areas can make changes or adaptations. There are a few instances where there's a legitimate option, for example, for the celebrant. I, as the priest, can choose Eucharistic prayer 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, for example. But I can't pick one that's not in the Roman Missal. I can't pick a prayer that's not in the sacramentary. I can't say, well, I found this on the internet. This is a good one. I'm not allowed to do that. And this document tells me why. This motu proprio of Paul VI, Sacrum Liturgium, as I said, was very short, but it's followed by another document from the Sacred Congregation of Rites, and its title is Inter Ecumenici, the instruction of the proper implementation of the Constitution and the Sacred Liturgy. This one, in particular, is a way in which the congregation, and remember, each congregation in Rome is a sub-department of the Holy See. The Holy Father can't do all this work by himself, so he has cardinals who work in his name under his authority, and they are in charge of these congregations. We have congregation for worship and the sacraments. We have a congregation for the clergy. We have a congregation for religious. We have a congregation for education. We have all these different departments, and their main job is to do the day-to-day business of the Vatican, of the Holy Father, and particularly when they issue these documents, they have the full authority of the Holy Father. They are speaking in his name. And so these are not just something that we can say, oh, that's a nice opinion. It's not opinion. In paragraph 3 of this document, we're told, it is of greatest importance that from the beginning, these documents should be rightly implemented everywhere, and that all possible doubts as to their interpretation should be eliminated. Right from the get-go, they're saying, look, we don't want problems. However, problems did occur while these were being written and after they were promulgated, because people were telling the congregation, they were telling people at home, the general masses, what they wanted to say, but not what the documents or what the Council Fathers said or intended to say. Again, to know the spirit of the law, one must know the letter of the law. In paragraph 5, first of all, it is essential that everybody be persuaded that the scope of the Constitution and the Sacred Liturgy is not limited merely to the changing of liturgical rites and texts. Rather, its aim is to foster the formation of the faithful and that pastoral activity of which the liturgy is the summit and the source. The changes in the liturgy which have already been introduced or which will be introduced later have this same end in view. And they quote, the footnote is from the Sacrosanctum Concilium, paragraph number 10. The source and summit of the Christian life is what? The divine liturgy, the Holy Eucharist. There is where you and I get our source and our strength. There's where we get the grace in order so that we can go and now be a good husband, a good father, a good wife, a good mother, a good worker, a good employee, a good employer, whatever. We cannot do anything without God's grace. We need God's grace to do everything. Alone we can do nothing but sin, as St. Augustine would tell us. But with God's grace, all things are possible. Where is the perfect, most sublime, infinite source of grace than the sacred liturgy, because it's God himself being communicated to us. Bishops and their helpers in the priesthood, therefore, should set great store by their whole liturgy-centered apostolate. Thus, the faithful too, by perfect participation in the liturgy, receive the divine life abundantly. And having become Christ's leaven and salt of the earth, they will announce and transmit it to others. Paragraph 8. Again, the congregation wants us to see that as we are implementing Sacrosanctum Concilium, the reform of the sacred liturgy, what are our goals and aims here? The sanctification, the holiness of all the members. But again, remembering the parameters. It is the universal church. It is Rome, the Vatican, who has the ultimate authority in making rules or changing them or eliminating them. It's not the priest who stands at the altar who can now decide, I don't like the Creed or Glory today, I'm not going to do it. It is not his option to do that. He has options that are clearly spelled out. It's not the option of the person who's playing the music. No, we don't like it today. We'll do something else. As we go on with this document, we want you to see how beautiful and attentive the cardinals, the congregation, the priests, and the theologians who are working painstakingly, making every effort to make sure that, again, the faith is preserved as well as, where needed, the means by transmitting the faith is updated. How these norms will apply? We see in paragraph 11, they begin talking about the liturgical formation of the clergy. It goes without saying that, especially at Vatican II, as many changes were taking place in the divine liturgy, it was absolutely essential that you go to the seminaries and bring this to the attention of those future priests, so that they would know what is to be expected of them. They're the ones who are being trained. Some of the men who professionally say were in the pipeline, those guys were in the seminary during the council. Some of them were preparing to celebrate the Mass as known today as the Tridentine Mass. And then all of a sudden, we switched to the Novus Ordo, the vernacular Mass. The orientation of the priests had changed. Many things had been developed. So those poor guys who were in between really had a lot of work to do. They had to not unlearn anything because what they learned in terms of theology, nothing changed. It's still the sacrifice of the Mass. How the Mass was celebrated, some minor adjustments had been made. In paragraph 13, liturgical ceremonies should be celebrated with the utmost perfection. This is in terms of seminaries, but this applies to every single parish, every church, every diocese. 13a, the rubrics are to be observed carefully, ceremonies to be performed with dignity under the watchful scrutiny of ecclesiastical superiors. They should be practiced beforehand. We see that word rubric. So many people take it as a dirty word, archaic pre-Vatican II concept. This is post-Vatican II, my friends. This is after the council, the Sacrosanctum Concilium was issued. We see this word rubric. It's not a bad word. A rubric is a norm, a law that applies to liturgy. For instance, the rubric at Mass, the priest places the bread and the wine on the altar. He should have a corporal on the altar. That's for a practical purpose in case any fragments from the host or any drops of wine or after the consecration, the precious blood, they could be absorbed by the corporal. And also, it has a very symbolic meaning because that area is where the priest focuses his primary attention when he's consecrating. We're also told in paragraph 13 now, every cleric should frequently exercise the liturgical activities proper to his order. Activities, that is to say, of deacon, subdeacon, acolyte, reader, and further, commentator and chanter. Finally, 13c, churches and oratories, church furnishings, and vestments should be examples of genuine Christian art, including modern art. Now, many people accentuated that last part, modern art. A lot of the liturgical style up until 1964 was predominantly Gothic or medieval, and that was used for over 400 years. They said now you can use some modern art. So adjustments were made to the vestments. They weren't changed completely. There's still a chasuble, priest still must wear a stole, still has to wear an alb, but the style had been modified. But notice, it doesn't say the old style is out. It doesn't say the Gothic vestments, the Roman vestments, what people called fiddlebacks, are now outlawed. It just said that you can adapt and use, and of course it would be to the discretion of the individual priest celebrant. Also the church, what they have available at the time. Nowhere do we see someone limiting in terms of personal taste. What's limited is in dogma or in theology. Now there's a little interesting footnote at the bottom of this page in this document, Inter Ecumenici. It says at the bottom of the page, the meaning is not that modern art is merely permissible, but just as in older churches one would expect to find genuine Christian art of that time, so in a modern church one would expect to find genuine Christian modern art. Again, you go into a modern structure, you expect the decor to blend in some way, that there is a harmony. The converse is equally true, my friends. If you have a Gothic church, you have a church that looks Baroque, then the vestments, the decorations, you want to have some synthesis going on. You want things to blend. You don't want stark contrasts. We see so many times in these older churches that are in good shape, they don't need to be repaired, except maybe a little paint job here and there, a little cleaning, but you've got gorgeous marble, you've got these beautiful frescoes, mosaics, and now all of a sudden you've got an altar that's not marble, that's made out of wood or stone, but it's some bizarre ultra-futuristic looking, and it doesn't go with the decor. Vatican II did not say that we mix and match. There should be some harmony there. Going on with the document, we have the liturgical formation of the faithful. Paragraph 19 tells us, pastors are to make it their business to implement with care and patience the precepts of the Constitution and the instruction of the faithful in the liturgy. How many times have pastors neglected to go and say to the people, this is why we're doing this. This is why we're celebrating Mass in the vernacular. This is why we're now going to have the option of going to confession face to face. This is why you have the option of receiving communion on the tongue or in the hand. Many times things were just done, or many times people weren't told that they had an option. I can't tell you how many people write to me and say, Father, I didn't realize that I can still receive on the tongue. I said, yes, that is your right under universal law of the church. You can receive communion on the tongue. You can go to confession anonymously. That is your right. And no priest has the right to restrict your right to exercise that option. Again, we see a very familiar phrase in paragraph 20. It belongs to the church's authority to regulate the sacred liturgy. Nobody, therefore, is allowed to proceed on his own initiative in this domain. For this would be a detriment of the liturgy itself, more often than not, and of the reform which the competent authority has to carry out. We're going to see throughout all the liturgical documents this theme that any Mass is the public worship of the whole church. There is no such thing as a private Mass. Even when a priest celebrates the Mass by himself, there may be no member of the faithful, maybe he doesn't even have a server, it's not a private Mass. He's not doing a singular private action, because at every single Mass, the whole church is there. He's united to the Pope, he's united to the Bishop, the souls in purgatory, the saints in heaven, and all the church militant on earth at every single Mass, whether there's one person there or it's a million people. And because of that, whether the priest is celebrating Mass by himself or he's celebrating with a congregation, he has to follow the same norms. He can't cut corners. He can't modify things. Another interesting note in this document is that we see that the council wanted us to have commissions set up. These are diocesan groups of priests, hopefully a few real liturgists, theologians, governed by the bishop, in which these implementations can take place, to help the parishes, to help the pastor, to help the priest, the people, see why are we doing these things. Sadly, what happened in many parishes, Father would just, one day, Mass, the priest was facing Ad Orientem, the next day he's facing the people, one day he's saying Mass in Latin, the next day he's saying in English, One day there's a communal railing there, the next day it's gone. All these things all of a sudden happened overnight, and many priests did not explain to the people why they were doing what they were doing, what was going to be done, and whose authority this was being done under. Some of the things were not even authorized. We're going to see in the documents that some of the things we see in some of our parishes were never mandated or even suggested by the council or the post-conciliar documents, but people were getting a little bit carried away as they were adapting and changing. And again, the document reminds us, it's not the individual priest, it's not the pastor, it's not even the individual bishop. It is the universal church, the pope, the bishops in union with him, the sacred congregation. We also have the episcopal commissions, okay, the national conference of bishops. But in the diocese, paragraph 47 tells us there should be a diocesan liturgical commission under the guidance of a bishop, must acquaint themselves with the pastoral liturgical activity of the diocese. They have to know what's going on. They have to know how many different groups of people are there. If you have masses that need to be said, for instance, in Spanish for the Hispanic people, if you need mass in Italian for the Italian, you've got a group of Italian immigrants. Maybe you need to have mass in Polish or Croatian or French or whatever. You need to address certain needs. You also need to know that there must be diligence in implementing what has been proposed. Things have to be done carefully, correctly, nothing haphazard. Individual cases, even for the diocese as a whole, they must suggest opportune plans for the progress of pastoral liturgical action. Each parish can have a liturgical committee. Now this committee is there to guide, to help the pastor, not to tell the pastor, look, this is what you're going to preach about this week. Not to tell the pastor, we're not going to wash feet this year, Father, Holy Thursday, we're going to wash hands. They have no authority to innovate. They have no authority to limit the priest's options, but they can make suggestions, different things that could be done to enhance the liturgy, maybe particular hymns or getting different choirs together, certain decorations, planning the big feasts so that it's not just something that one person does or that one person plans and does all the work, but that this is a whole parish endeavor. For instance, Corpus Christi, you can get all the parish organizations to show up, a representative from each one, the parish council, the women's council, Rosary and Altar Society, the ushers, the altar servers, everybody involved, and then have a procession, not just through the church, maybe outside, around the block. Well, that takes planning, it takes coordination, and this is something that a liturgy committee could help. Also, at the Easter Vigil, if you're going to confirm and baptize a number of people, to let those people know that they are not just Catholics sacramentally, but they're also Catholics in a social sense. Get them acquainted with the different organizations that are in the church by getting these organizations present and participating at the Easter Vigil itself. The document also talks about sacramentals. The blessings which are listed in the Roman ritual, this is paragraph number 77, which up to now have been reserved, may henceforth be given by any priest, except for the following: the blessing of bells, the foundation stone of a church, of a new oratory. In the past, many of the blessings were saved for the bishop and priests with special faculties, like only Dominicans could do the rosary, Carmelites, the scapular, and so on. Well, now, because there are so few, and because they want people to know they can go to almost any priest at any time, there are not as many restrictions anymore. Something big, of a big nature, for instance, the blessing of a seminary, the blessing of a church, this is done by a bishop. However, someone could come to me, a priest, and go to their deacon and ask for, Father, could you bless these rosaries? Could you bless this Bible, the scapular, whatever. Certain things the bishop can delegate to the particular priest. For instance, if a new station of the cross were erected, the bishop can say to the pastor, I would like you to bless it because I'm not able to get to every single parish in the diocese. Certain blessings can be done even without a priest in the new Book of Blessings, De Benedictionibus. People can be deputed, delegated to give a blessing. However, they don't make the sign of the cross, okay? Just as under certain circumstances, someone can be delegated by the bishop as an extraordinary minister of the Eucharist following the proper parameters and guidelines, so too a layperson in the absence of a priest or a deacon can impose ashes, can bless throats. But they must follow the norms, the rubrics, and they don't make the sign of the cross because that is a sign of holy orders. This document, therefore, is of great importance to us because it highlights the fundamental principle that the sacred liturgy is regulated by universal authority of the church, and it is for the purpose of sanctification of all the members. It is not for just my purpose as the priest or your individual needs, but all of us together, because we're family. We're a spiritual family. We really want you to know that these documents are not something secret. They're not something that are only for theologians or seminarians or liturgical experts. They're for everybody. So I encourage you to get a copy. Read these documents. Thank you. May God bless you and Mary keep you.